I'm starting a new sermon series today called Surviving Life, and we're going to be talking about three different subjects over the next 3 weeks. Today, staying connected to God. Next week, staying connected to your purpose. That third week, staying connected to those that you care about. And then on that fourth week, September the 8th, a really cool service that we're calling Belong, which will talk about the ways in which the church helps us to do all of those things. I've been thinking about this, surviving life. The great biblical insights that we get about life are consistent with much of the research I've been reading from the fields of psychology and sociology about how we survive life, how we maintain good and joyful lives in the midst of tough times. So staying connected to God, staying connected to others, staying connected to our purpose. I looked through the New Testament and Old Testament both to find a text for this subject, and I have returned to what I think is the greatest story in Western civilization. We've talked about it a lot, but there's no story that deals with this issue better than Luke's story, the prodigal son. We should give thanks to Luke because he's the only one, you know, of our synoptic gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Luke is the only one that tells this story, and it is a remarkable, remarkable story. So we'll start here in the 15th chapter. Then Jesus said, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me.' So he divided his property between them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all he had and traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered his property, every penny, we should say, in dissolute living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to the fields to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself," and that's a powerful phrase, when he came to himself, hopefully it happens to all of us now and then, "he said, 'How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up, I will go to my father. I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and he went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran and put his arms around him and kissed him. Then the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly bring out a robe, the best one, and put it on him. And put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. And get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. I wonder how many of you recognize the name Max Baer Sr. Max Baer Sr., Max Baer Sr. was a heavyweight fighter in the 1930s. If you're a baby boomer, you're more likely to recognize the name Max Baer Jr., who played Jethro on the Beverly Hillbillies, right? Absolutely. But we're not talking about the Beverly Hillbillies today. We're talking about Max Baer Sr. He was a heavyweight fighter. He was actually a gifted athlete and a gifted boxer. But he was not a disciplined athlete. And so he oftentimes did not train well. When he was in shape, he was a formidable fighter. He actually won the heavyweight championship in 1934. But when he had not been training, he was easy pickings. A number of years ago, the Sports Illustrated carried a story about him. It's one of my very favorite stories, about a fight that he had one time when he had not been training hard. His first round went okay because he was the superior of the two fighters, but he came out of the first round and he was already winded. The second round of the fight started going downhill. He got cut a couple of times on the face. The third fight, he was awful. And he came out of the third round with a swollen eye. By the end of the fourth round, he literally stumbled to his corner. He had one eye completely closed, a cut in the other eye. They couldn't stop the bleeding. The great Jack Dempsey was in his corner that night, and he tried to encourage him. He looked down at him. He said, "Don't worry, kid. He hasn't laid a glove on you yet." And Max Baer looked up through the blood and the swollen eyes, and he said, "Well, if that's the case, you keep an eye on that referee, because somebody in there is beating the heck out of me." Or words to that effect. Who hasn't felt that way at one point or another? I'm not going to ask you to raise hands, but honestly, is there anyone in this room today who in the past year hasn't just felt themselves driven to their knees by the circumstances of life? Maybe a crisis, maybe an illness, maybe the grief of a lost one, but sometimes life just tends to overwhelm us. I have a friend who's a member of this church. He's had a tough time. He once said to me, I'll never forget these words. He said, "You know, if in life, if God is the dealer, he's a lousy dealer because it isn't fair. And life hasn't been fair to him." And I think that's true with a lot of us as we look around and we observe the way life just unfolds oftentimes. If we were to use the Max Baer metaphor, we would say that if God is the referee, then somebody needs to keep an eye on the referee, right? Because life can get tough. There's no story that tells the Max Baer story in the New Testament better than the story of the prodigal son. And through the years, we've talked about the prodigal son. It's the younger son. He goes to his father. He asks for his inheritance, even though he is still young. And if you read the scholars, what the scholars say about this text, they'll say that this was literally unthinkable in that particular time. That for him to go to his father, first of all, to be the younger son and to ask for his inheritance, just wouldn't have happened. It wouldn't have happened for a son to ask for it at all. So it was considered to be an act of unbelievable rebelliousness, disobedience, impudence, and culturally, it was just simply unthinkable. But through the years, I've tried to think about this in contemporary terms and give the kid a little bit of a break. So let's think about this just a bit together. What if he was just an extremely ambitious young man? There's nothing wrong with that, right? He'd grown up with his father's largesse around him. He was probably spoiled. His father had lots of land, lots of crops, lots of animals and servants. What if he said, "I don't need this. I want to make it on my own"? Those are admirable attributes, aren't they? Just particularly independent. What if he had a dream, a vision about his life? He said, "I've been here on the farm all my life. I've been faithful to my father, but I have a vision, a dream that's different from that. I'd like to go to the city and see what I can do." Wanted to be an entrepreneur, maybe. Or consider this possibility that he was sick and tired of living under the thumb of his insufferable elder brother. You continue to read the story, you'll find the story of a self-righteous and legalistic elder brother. It couldn't have been much fun. Let's just give him the benefit of the doubt. One way or the other, the father says, "Here's your inheritance." He takes his money and he goes to the far country. The New Testament says that he goes and he just immediately starts spending his money in dissolute living, but I want to give him a break again. Maybe he goes and he gives it a try. He's trying to have a startup company, maybe a phone company of some kind or robotics or something. I don't know. But what we know is that a famine hit the country. What today we would call a recession. A recession takes over and he goes under. One afternoon, he walks into the casino. He sits down at the blackjack table and he pulls out his last $20 bill and he bets it all. And he loses it all. He loses it all. And soon he finds himself on his knees, living like a pig, living like a pig. We've all been there, haven't we? Sometimes we go to our knees. Most of the time, life drives us to our knees. And at one point, he makes this decision. He realizes that he can't fix what's wrong on the outside of his life until he fixes what's wrong on the inside of his life. And he can't fix what's wrong on the inside of his life until he repairs and restores his relationship with his father. He gets up. He goes back home. You and I know what this story is about, don't we? We know that this is a story about you and me and our relationship to God. I love the fact that you're here this morning. It says you've got a relationship with God of some kind or another. Chris said this last week. You're here, and so you've got a relationship with God, or you're looking for a relationship with God. You're trying to repair a relationship with God. But we all know that sustaining a vital relationship, life-giving relationship with God, can get difficult at times. Because there's this human tendency that we see in this story, and we know it in ourselves. There is this human tendency to drift away from God. Sometimes the biggest problem that can happen in our lives when things are going so well, when life is going well, we tend to think, oh, you know, I've got it. And we drift away from God because we don't think we need God anymore. And then there are those times when we just kind of get seduced away from our relationship with God. And there are a lot of things that will do that, and you've experienced those in your life. Several years ago, I wrote this book about the Lord's Prayer. It's called Pray Like Jesus. And it was based on a sermon series I had done, and a lot of you heard those sermons. I love writing this book, and I wrote one chapter about each phrase of the prayer. Our Father who art in heaven. And I wrote a chapter about that. And so this is my confession. When I got to the last phrase of the prayer, thine is the kingdom, thine is the power, thine is the glory, I was tired of writing, right? And I was convinced that the most important chapters of the prayer, the ones that I'd spent a lot of time, were the middle chapters. Give us this day our daily bread. You've heard me talk about that a lot. It's a great Old Testament and New Testament theme. And then the phrases on forgiveness. Forgive us our sins as we forgive others. Jesus didn't give us a choice on that. So I'd spent a lot of time on those middle chapters, the middle phrases. By the time I got to the end, thine is the kingdom, thine is the power, thine is the glory, I was just tired. I said, you know, this is really nothing more than kind of the sign-off. Jesus gave the sign-off to the prayer. Here, disciples, just thine is the kingdom. So I sent in my first draft to Abingdon Press. I had a great editor at Abingdon Press named Ron Kidd. I'm still grateful to him for the ways in which he helped me, made a better writer out of me. And he set up a phone call one day. We had a conference call. He said, Don, I've got your first draft. He said, I really like it. You've approached this in a way that's different from anybody else that's talked about prayer. I talked about it in terms of our spiritual lives, the practice of prayer and meditation. He said, but I've got a problem with your last chapter. He says, you need to beef up this last chapter. For thine is the kingdom, thine is the power, thine is the glory. You hardly say anything about it at all. People need to know more than that. And I said, well, Ron, I don't think it's all that important. It's just kind of Jesus' sign-off, don't you think? He said, no, I don't think so. He said, you need to beef it up some. I said, okay. So I worked on it a little bit more. I put in this part, it's called the doxology. Scholars call that last phrase the doxology. And I thought about the fact that we live in such a narcissistic era, and the prayer moves us away from our narcissism. And so I said, the emphasis when you pray this prayer should be not, it should be on thine. Thine is the kingdom. Thine is the power rather than mine. Thine is the glory rather than mine. And I thought that was good enough. I sent it off. He accepted it. But honestly, I went back and looked at it yesterday. I only wrote 2 pages. And so the point is, this is about confession, because if I were to write that book again, that last chapter would be a lot more robust. And the reason is, the spiritual work I've done in my own life since I wrote that book has convinced me about how important and powerful those three things are in terms of seducing us away from our relationship with God. It is, after all, the kingdom things, money and wealth and things, and power and glory. Those are the things that seduce us away from our relationship with God. There's a great story in the New Testament where this man called the rich young ruler, some of you know this story, a young man who's very, very wealthy, comes to Jesus and he says, "Good teacher, tell me what I must do to inherit the kingdom of God." And Jesus is really nice to him. It's Mark that says Jesus looked at him and he loved him. He's really nice to him, but he says, "Let me tell you something. You have a problem in your life." He said, "You've got a lot of stuff. You've got horses and cows and mules and donkeys and land, and you've got these servants carrying these big treasure chests full of gold and silver." And he said, "The problem is that you no longer own these things. These things own you. And you can't repair your relationship with God until you get rid of them." That hits home, doesn't it? I mean, a lot of us are really good at making money and really good at collecting stuff. I've got a lot of stuff in my life. And there's nothing wrong as long as we own the stuff and the stuff doesn't own us. Jesus said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and everything else is okay." So that's a pretty good guideline. But we all get seduced by the kingdom stuff, don't we? So we are tempted. We're tempted to get to that place where our stuff owns us and we don't own our stuff. And when that happens, we have shoved God completely away. "For thine is the kingdom, for thine is the power." I don't think there's anything in the world more seductive than power. I was reading the Wall Street Journal the other day, and I was looking at the political races. I don't remember exactly, but I think there are now 325 Democrats running for presidency of the United States. I mean, some of them I don't even know, but I mean, there are a lot of people. And if it were the other way around, it'd be the same with the Republicans too. You know, I'm equal opportunity here. And there's some really old people running for president, and there are some really young people, and there are some people in between. And look, I know they've all got great visions about what they think America should be. I'm sure that for the most part, they're driven by pure motives. They want America to be better. They want better policies for people. But with that many people running for president, you and I would never fool ourselves by suggesting that it has nothing to do with power, would we? We know how seductive power is. The Democrats, the Republicans on the left and the right. And if we get real honest with ourselves about personal power, we love to have power. We are seduced by power. And ultimately, the quest for power will separate us from God. "For thine is the glory." I was thinking about this one. I think if I had written this book in the 1950s, it wouldn't have been a very big deal. David Brooks has written about this, the difference between the 1950s and later, kind of a dividing point there, where we just became Joe Namath and Johnny Unitas could have cared less about the fame. Joe Namath was on every magazine cover. People coming in from the farms like Johnny Unitas and others, We weren't as narcissistic back then, but today we live in the world of the internet, and we know there are people who are famous just for being famous. The most narcissistic era, I think, in the history of civilization. One of our youth ministers years ago came to me. He said, "Do you know what the most important ambition, the most named ambition is?" He'd done a survey, I think, with our young people in our youth group. I thought, "Oh, maybe they want to be an astrophysicist? A neurosurgeon?" He said, "No." He said, "The majority of them say, I want to be famous. I just want to be famous." I don't know what made me think about this, but you remember a number of years ago when Michael Jordan was selling a lot of shoes. He was more visible than he is now. Great basketball player. And this phrase came up in our popular culture, "I want to be like Mike." Every teenager was saying, "I want to be like Mike." And I thought about that. Were they saying, "I want to be a great basketball player like Mike"? Maybe some of them were. But I think what they were really saying is, "I want to be famous like Mike. I want to be rich like Mike. I want to be powerful like Mike." And let me tell you, you can't be like Mike and be like Jesus at the same time. This is such a powerful story because it's a story about you and me. And it's a story about our relationship with God. Because we know that sooner or later, we will get disconnected from God. It will happen to every single one of us sooner or later. And when the time comes, we will either choose to go to our knees or we will be driven to our knees. And this is a story that tells us when that moment comes, the only way to deal with it is to say this. The only way to deal with what's taking place on the outside of my life is to fix what's taking place and what is broken on the inside of my life. And the only way to do that is to restore my relationship with God. The only way to do that is to go home.